All right. In the cause of being accurate, the movie was The Abyss, not Sphere. I sort of remember them. Both Sphere came to mind, but no, it was definitely The Abyss. All right, coming up, we're going to talk again about energy with Dr. Mark Eberhard. He's the author of Why Things Break. And maybe he can tell me why my computer went belly up, the motherboard went yesterday. And another another book called Feeding the Fire. Fortunately, it didn't catch fire. At age 16, Mark enrolled the University of Colorado. That's where he received both a BS with majors in chemistry and applied mathematics and an MS in physical biochemistry. In 1979, he applied and was accepted to MIT as a PhD candidate studying materials science and engineering. At the same time that Mark was preparing for his move to Boston, the Iranian Revolution was in full swing, and gasoline here in the U.S., you recall, in very short supply. Undeterred by the uncertainty, Mark placed 6 5-gallon cans full of gas right next to all his other possessions and rented U-Haul headed for the east. His trip seemed and seeded an interest in energy science and policy that never faded. 4 years later, Mark received his PhD, and he was one of a handful of scientists attempting to understand fracture at the quantum mechanical level. Wow. The pursuit took him from MIT to Los Alamos National Labs, there to the premier university for engineering in the Rocky Mountains, Colorado School of Mines, where he is now a professor teaching chemistry and materials science. He's a consultant to NOVA, very popular show, and a popular speaker giving presentations as diverse as the role of science in society to Boston's great molasses disaster and other failures that have shaped engineering, science, and technology. Coming up in just a moment, Dr. Mark Eberhard. All right, Dr. Mark Eberhard, welcome to Coast AM.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. Just before we delve into Feeding the Fire, I'm curious about your other book, Why Things Break. Tell me about Why Things Break.
Well, actually, a number of people have noted that the thing that I don't do in the book is actually explain why things break.
I see.
The title actually came from my questions that I started asking when I was 5 years old, when I was thinking about things and watching things break and wondering why they happened. And so the book was about how that question it influenced my life, but more importantly, how it's been a question that's influenced so much of science and engineering for almost 10,000-15,000 years. The question to try to deal with things breaking and how that's shaped science and engineering.
Professor, a lot of us feel that things are designed to break. And that the if we designed them so they didn't break, the economy would collapse eventually.
Yeah, I've heard that, and to a certain extent that's true. We can design things that don't break, that take a lot more punishment than they do today. I mean, one of the things that's quite clear is that today I just doled out a $1,500 to replace to correct a small dent on my car, and you sit there and go, why should it be that much? When of course we could build cars that stood up to a great deal more punishment. Take for example, when you look at the cars that they use in racing. I mean, they'll smash into a wall at 200 miles an hour, and by and large, the people inside come off okay most of the time.
That's true, but the cars are generally wrecked, but you're right. I mean, they protect the people.
Yeah.
I read a recent headline that said cars may sooner than later actually be able to repair themselves. Bet you wish you had one of those.
Today I wish I had one of those.
Yeah, exactly. And I just finished replacing a computer where the motherboard went belly up. No doubt some small stinky little component, capacitor or diode or something, went belly up, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, what you find out after owning a computer for 4 or 5 years is one little tiny component goes, nothing else is compatible, and therefore you have to replace the entire thing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
So, I don't know.
And you're wondering why?
Yeah, and you're obviously not going to have the answer.
Well, but you do realize that they can build things that, for instance, computers that come up to military specifications, they are much more reliable. But by the same token, they're much more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's playing the game. I mean, how much do you want to pay for your computer? And you want it to last long enough that the next generation of computers is going to get there. But I agree with you. There's a lot of design that could make things much, much easier.
I want it to last long enough so that I look at it one day and say, this sucker is too slow. It's out. I want a new one.
Uh-huh.
That's how long I want it to last. But
and did it make it for you?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No. No, but I guess 4 years in the computer world is not bad. All right, on to feeding the fire and energy. America is certainly, if you look at the gas prices, we're in trouble. I'm not going to go beyond that right now. I'm just going to say if you look at the gas prices, a lot of people are in trouble. Gas is expensive and going to get worse.
Yeah, it probably is going to get worse. And it is expensive. What one has to think about, though, is, well, there's a couple things there. One is that if you're looking for alternative fuels, and there's a number of reasons why we should be doing that, that one of the bright sides of having high energy costs or high gas costs particularly is that it encourages entry into the market. That right now people are looking, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, one of the things that's going on right now is biofuels, and biofuels are suddenly becoming competitive. Another thing that's going on.
Well, wait a minute. Stop. Let me stop you. Is it a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, biofuels, as it currently is, I think it's a bad idea. I think the way we're getting biofuels from corn, it's not at all clear to many people whether there's a net energy savings or a net energy loss. And you're driving this by basically you're taking just a little bit of the energy out of the plant, that is the corn kernels, and turning that into alcohol. Now, if what's driving that process is farm subsidies, there's a huge subsidy going to develop ethanol production in the United States.
I heard a story earlier today, Professor. It said that the cost of bread is going through the roof, and the reason is because farmers are switching to corn because corn is becoming such a cash crop because of energy.
Yeah, because of energy and because of the subsidy, and that's absolutely right. What you've got to realize, if we were to be, if we were extracting more energy out of the corn plant, that's actually taking the stalk and the cob and all of that and converting that to alcohol as well, then we'd have something that had some future to it. But the way it's going now, no. The technology I'm talking about is called cellulosic ethanol. And we cannot convert, we have the technology to do it, but we're not doing it, converting cellulose into ethanol. And that has some reasonable future, and that has some hope to offset our dependence on foreign oil. But the current situation, I don't think using just corn, that's a good idea. And as you said, it's forcing the price of grains up in general.
Right. You make a link between energy and imagination, and I can't figure out how you make that link. Tell me.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things that prompted me to write the book. When we use energy, everything that's alive needs energy to survive, and that's what we get from food or from sunlight in the case of plants.
Sure.
And but what humankind did is they use energy to feed the fires of their imagination, and that's where the title for the book came from. Everything that we use energy for is, or almost everything, is essentially a product of our imaginations. Automobiles are product of our imaginations, and books are products of our imagination, and all of these things are basically things that we have created, and we have used the energy to give substance to all of those things that we imagine. So I look at energy as the food that fuels our minds and has changed the world in that regard. And to talk about energy separate from imagination and separate from our progress is, I think, does a disservice to how complex the energy issue is.
I suppose you're right. Our imagination keeps coming up with these new high-tech devices of one sort and another, and they all require energy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think of anything that's been created, and you'll realize that it not only relies on energy now, but it builds on things that required energy in the past. And so we've kind of built all of our knowledge we've acquired through the exploitation of energy. And so our world today is really one that we have built with our minds using energy.
Is there a way to measure how much actual energy of all forms that we're using today versus 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, that kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. You can look at the growth curves. I can't give you exact numbers, but that's readily available. And we are using energy yet. We're exploiting our energy use is increasing at an exponential rate. I won't even hazard to guess at numbers, but it's just an astronomical increase over the last half century.
And how would you propose to change this, and what do you imagine will occur if we don't?
Well, you know, there are two things that are really important in this country, to the world in general, but particularly this country. The first is our energy dependency. We currently import about half of the oil we use in this country. Now, that, by and large, that wouldn't be a problem if it weren't for the fact that it drives the cost of oil up for the rest of the world. But also, it accounts for about a third of our balance of trade deficit. And so we're shipping money overseas, and a good part of it that is going to
our enemies,
those nations in the Mideast that we would our enemies. And if there is a tremendous act of terrorism someday, and we want to follow that, we pretty well can. We're paying for that every time we fill up our cars. And then, of course, the other issue is the one that Vice President Gore has brought up, that of global warming and global climate change.
Yes.
The more we're reliant on fossil fuels, the more CO2 we produce in the atmosphere. And if you're not concerned about it now, you have to forecast 20 years into the future when China is doubled its energy usage, most of it in the form of coal.
I've had a couple of guests tell me recently that they expect China to pass our energy consumption within the year.
Yes, and in fact, they are now the greatest producer of carbon in the world.
Already?
Already, yes. Oh, and so if you follow that train backwards, or forwards, I should say, we're coming to the point where, climate change is an issue, and we should consider that.
How much of an issue, in your opinion, Doctor?
I personally think the evidence is overwhelming that there is currently climate change. I don't think there's anybody who questions that. The issue that that scientists bring up is, can we actually attribute it to human activity? In my opinion, yeah, you can contribute it. You can attribute it to human activity. There are reputable scientists who say that evidence is not in yet. Nonetheless, no one disputes the fact that 50 years from now, we're going to be pumping 4 or 5 times as much carbon in the atmosphere if we don't change our ways. And at some point, it's going to become if it's not already now, then it will be shortly. Humankind will be making a big change to the environment.
Well, many people, as you pointed out, already are saying that.
Yes.
The United States wants to remove some wording coming out. Let's see. Let me read you this. In BBC News, Richard Black reports the U.S. has proposed the following revisions. Removing sentences that say climate change is speeding up and will seriously damage our common natural environment and severely weaken the global economy. Resolute action is urgently needed in order to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions and quote, "We are deeply concerned about the latest findings confirmed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change." We want to remove all that wording, Doctor.
Yeah, and that's a not just in that area, but that's a general assault on science that's been going on by the Bush administration since it, well, for the last 7 years.
I'm not a fan or a critic, really, either way, of the Bush administration, except when it comes to this. How long do you think it's going to be, Doctor, before we are forced by the changes that are upon us to stop removing the wording and stop and yank our head up out of the sand and admit what's going on?
I think it's past time now. There, you know, the evidence is superficial, and it's hard to give cause and effect in this area. For instance, it's hard to say that Katrina was caused by global warming. Yet,
of course,
it's not impossible to draw the link and say more of this kind of thing will happen. We've had very strange weather patterns. It's hard to say, oh, those are a result of global warming. But nonetheless, you know, the way I like to think about it is this: if you told me you were going to take me someplace and drop me off someplace in the world, and I wasn't going to know where it was going to be, and you gave me a half an hour to pack, well, I'd pack for the extremes. I'd pack, you know, for the desert. So I take sunscreen, and I take a parka and gloves in case you drop me off somewhere at the pole. So I'd prepare for the extremes, and I think that's what we really have to start doing, is preparing for the extremes. Things are happening, and we have to start getting ready.
What made you decide to write this book?
Pardon me?
What made you decide to write this book?
Well, part of what bothered me was the fact that we are such a, for instance, as laudable as Gore's movie and book are, they still hit me with the fact that they leave people, they're trying to generate people and get people to make changes based on fear, that global warming is something that's going to happen. It's going to turn the earth into deserts, and we have to do something. So it's driving us on a process of fear. Historically, we've seen other times when we've run out of energy. One of those times was during medieval Europe, that the forests were being cut down at an alarming rate in order to meet the needs for energy, for wood, for navies, that kind of thing. And what history tells us is that the change does not have to be as drastic as we think it is.
Really?
What I like to think about is how much knowledge we have accumulated. And this goes back to the title of the book. We know so much about energy. We know how to get energy out of sunlight, out of the earth's heat. We know how to get energy from oil shale locked up in Colorado. We know how to get it from gas hydrates at the bottom of the ocean. We know so much about energy at this point, which at other points in history when they were facing energy crisis, they didn't know. And this shouldn't be a time for fear. This should be a time for tremendous optimism, that we have the opportunity now to literally shape the world, to take this resource that we are so dependent on and put it in a form where we can control it, where it's renewable.
Professor, I'm very optimistic about the technological possibilities that are in front of us in terms of how to collect energy. There are many.
Oh.
How to get it from the sun, as you pointed out. Wind energy is a wonderful way to collect energy. They're out there, but I'm pessimistic about our political will to do what needs to be done in time to prevent a catastrophic result.
Yeah, and that's the reason I wrote the book. The idea here is people who are afraid, who are being told that...
I'll tell you what, hold that thought. We're at break point. I have to break right here, Professor. Dr. Mark Eberhardt is my guest. We'll be right back. Dr. Mark Eberhardt is here. He's talking about energy. Now, I wasn't around for the apparent wood shortage in jolly old England, way back when, but I was around for the 70s when gas got rare at the pumps. We all had to line up. There was an embargo, and all they did was cut some of what we were getting. And, oh, it was mean out there. There were fist fights. There were long lines. It was unbelievable. Could that happen again today? Yes, it could, and pretty soon at that. We'll be right back. You know, Doctor, it seems to me that even if you disregard the climate changes that I think you and I agree we're going through right now, and you disregard oil and energy as a national security imperative, which it is, and you recognize the fact we're paying mostly our enemies, you know, in the Middle East, some in South America, all the places where the oil seems to be, we're having to pay our enemies this premium, and we're funding perhaps our own eventual doom, that it's such a matter of national security that even if it wasn't for the atmospheric problems we're having right now, we would be looking to be energy independent anyway.
No, absolutely. And one of the points I like to make is, if this were a plot that was hatched by the Soviet Union, we would respond in an aggressive way. Unfortunately, it's not a plot spawned by the Soviet Union, and we seem to just kind of ignore it. At least our political leaders seem to ignore it and say, we don't have to worry about this now. And to me, that's frightening.
All right, let's talk about when we do have to worry about it. If it's not now, then here's a question I'd like answered. Is there going to be a point at which there's less oil available than there has been in our history? In other words, peak oil. Is there really going to be a peak oil point?
You know, personally, I don't think so.
Really?
When they talk about peak oil, they're talking about what is called conventional oil. And every year, unconventional sources become more useful. Right now, we get most, our biggest supplier of oil outside of this country is actually Canada. And that's coming from oil resources that 10 years ago we didn't count. They said they didn't exist. Now they do, because those come from tar sands. Right now in Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, we have more oil shale than any place in the world. We have 800 billion gallons of, barrels, 800 billion barrels of oil in those, in the oil shale there. Now that is expensive to extract, but when the price gets up where it is now.
How expensive? In other words, at what point will it be competitive with the, pick a price.
Yeah, I have heard the price of $40 a barrel. At that point, it becomes feasible, 40 or 50. So for the last year or two, we have been over that amount, and that's why a number of different oil companies are up there now exploring how they're going to go about extracting that oil from the oil shale and how they can do it in an environmentally benign manner. And so I do not believe we're ever going to see the point where we reach peak oil. We will see a point where the price dictates what the extraordinary means we can use to get at oil and energy.
All right. Well, right now, premium here is around $3.30 or $3.40, somewhere in there. Where is it going, in your opinion, and how soon?
You mean where is the price going?
That's right.
The price is going up, and the price is going to continue to go up, and that's not so much because of how much oil is available, but because of the limited refinery capabilities in this country. We have very limited refinery capabilities, haven't built new refineries in, I believe, 15, 20 years. So we're operating right at about 85-90% of our refining capability now, and until we build new refineries, that's where it's going to be, and the price is going to keep going up because demand's going up.
Huh. Will it go up? Let me try this. What would happen if we were cut off from oil in the Mideast?
Oh, it'd be catastrophic.
Catastrophic.
The same thing. If the same thing were to happen, that would happen in, as you mentioned, in when Iran basically cut off three million barrels a day. That just threw the whole world into a tizzy. if the same thing were to happen now, it would be catastrophic. If the Saudis were for some reason to say, we're not pumping anymore, it would be that the whole world would go into a major collapse.
Major collapse.
That's my opinion, and I'm not an economist, of course.
Well, that doesn't exactly comfort me at all. I went through the one in the 70s. I remember fights and lines and all kinds of trouble. Did you go through that one?
And it was horrible. I remember going through exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And it was a horrible experience, particularly for people in this country who assumed that gasoline is our heritage. We're entitled to it. And it was a very, very ugly situation. And the same thing would happen again if the Saudis, for instance, or if Venezuela or the Canadians, I think we can count on the Canadians.
Well, perhaps the Canadians, yes.
But nonetheless, yes, it's a frightening situation, particularly that the oil is sitting in the hands of people who are not countries that I think we should be dependent upon.
And if you were the president of the United States, what would your directives be? What would you change right now?
Right now, I would begin by turning to our oil shale. I would turn to our oil shale, and I would subsidize the development of oil shale. I would subsidize the development of alternative sources of fuel. I mean, it's crazy that we have built no nuclear power plants since Chernobyl, since Three Mile Island. That technology is very important.
It's good technology, but of course we haven't figured out exactly what to do with the waste. They want to put it in my state here in Nevada, and we have to, I'm told, be good caretakers of it for perhaps hundreds of thousands of years, and I don't know what we've taken care of. We can go back to your other book, Why Things Break.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah. And in terms of nuclear waste, yeah, that's a legitimate concern. But one of the things that people don't recognize is that, for instance, France has a very successful nuclear program. They supply 80% of their electricity via
right.
nuclear, and they cope with the reactor problem with the waste problem by recycling by reprocessing fuel. In this country, or in the world, actually, the most successful producer of nuclear power is the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Navy has operated reactors since 1955. It operates more reactors than any other entity in the world. It's done so without a single accident. There is the problem with waste associated even with naval reactors, but nonetheless, that shows what can be done if cost is not the object. That is, safety is the object, and reliability is the object. We can build very safe and reliable nuclear reactors.
And let's go back to France. If France can do it, why can't we?
Part of it is, again, the issue of fear. Three Mile Island, particularly, we had a number of people who were very vocal about what would come about from a nuclear meltdown. Jane Fonda was one of those people. So there are a number of people who basically seed the fear instead of doing what I would like to do, and particularly through my book, is talk about the power of technology, and that if we approach things in a logical way instead of fear-based, and if we understand the technologies, we can make as a country, each and every person can help to make enlightened decisions about what we should be doing for energy. And it's very important that people get involved in that discussion. And involved in a knowledgeable way.
Well, I guess my question is, if France can handle the nuclear waste and recycle it, why in the world can we not?
Well, part of that is the fact that they had a very well thought out reactor program where they used standard reactors. We didn't do that. It's part of the political system, part of the planning process. But there is no could not do that now. And over the last 20 years, the technologies have developed to make reactors even safer and reduce the amount of waste associated with reactors. And there's also programs out there, but they're far off in the future, which can actually accelerate the rate at which nuclear decay occurs, and so you can get rid of your waste much faster.
I've heard about that.
Yeah.
Is that what France is doing?
No, they're simply reprocessing. So they take all of their reactor rods and send them to a central location where they reprocess them and then use them over again. And so that takes care of their high-level waste.
Then why can't we do that?
We could. And there's no reason we couldn't do that.
All right. Why aren't we doing that?
Well, I think the biggest reason is, again, fear. It's been very hard to get a nuclear reactor up and running since Three Mile Island. Also, because we went about doing this in such a strange way where we didn't use a standard reactor design, which we improved, but just every different reactor was a new design, which we'd see what would happen. Part of that process was that we ran way over budget. Many of the reactors they were building in the Northwest just were extraordinarily over budget, and they walked away with them. They invested $20 billion in these things, then turned around and walked away and took the Northwest from the place that had the least expensive electricity in the world in the United States, to one of the places with the highest electricity bills.
Oy. So bad decisions.
Very, very bad decisions. Not planned out. And in my mind, part of what goes on there is that we think of energy as a economic resource. So we leave it up to businesses to do this. And they, of course, they want to maximize their profits. So they're going to do whatever they can do to do within reason. They're going to do what they can do by minimizing the cost of development. And that's not the way to do it. And that's why in my book, I urge, in fact, that we take another approach. If we think about energy as a security issue, you know, think about it in the same context as we do an aircraft carrier battle group, then we don't ask the question, how much is this going to cost? We say, how much security is it going to bring? And I think that's the way we need to look at energy issues in the future.
Okay. One of the concerns with nuclear reactors, of course, is proliferation. Are you concerned about that?
Yeah, and I've heard a number of people talk about the possibility of proliferation, and then you're leading to nuclear weapons. And by the way, that's one of the things that scares me amazingly, the idea that a terrorist group would get a nuclear weapon. To me, that's the most terrifying thing that could happen in the way of terrorism. And some of the new reactors that they've developed, which are called these pebble bed reactors, they encase the nuclear material in ceramics. They make it very, very difficult to reprocess. And I think this is a surmountable problem, that there is a way to build reactors and keep and reduce the possibility of proliferation. I believe that is doable. It's going to be hard, and it's going to be one of those concerns we have to keep in mind at all times.
Mm. Back to the atmosphere for a moment. You did see the movie, Vice President Gore's movie, right?
Yes, I did.
And did you believe the science was accurate?
Now there are two things going on there. Yes, his science is accurate. That is, particularly the ice core data. The ice core data he shows is accurate, and that's where we can correlate the CO2 levels in the atmosphere with global temperatures over 700,000 years. And that shows that whenever the temperature goes up, CO2 is going up too, though it doesn't establish a cause and effect necessarily. And then it does show that CO2 levels are at their highest level in that 700,000 years. So that science is correct. All the science he says is correct. Where I disagree in a minor way with Vice President Gore is predicting what the climate will be like. That is, talking about the fact that we're going to have deserts and this kind of thing. I don't believe we know that. And there are many very reputable climatologists who say, we don't know for sure what the world's going to look like if we have global warming. Will it be wetter because now it's hotter, and so we'll be putting out more moisture into the air and more rain. Will we leave deserts? I don't think people really know what's going to happen. But nonetheless, change in any form, whether we take an area like Colorado or Nevada and suddenly make it now wetter, that could lead to the same devastating effects as making the Northeast drier. So change is not the friend of things that are established.
Right.
And we are established. The human beings are established, and the plants we live on are established. And any kind of change is something we don't want to see happen.
You mentioned solar dimming, and I really don't know what that is, and its effect on global warming. What is solar dimming?
Well, solar dimming, that's a very interesting thing, because oftentimes, and I've heard this coming out of people in the administration who talk about this, in what was it, the early 1970s, I think, scientists were forecasting a new ice age. And people talk about this. They say, they forecasted that ice age back there, and that never happened, and now they're talking about global warming. So really, no one knows what's going on. But the interesting thing about that was they couldn't figure out. It looked like things were getting colder, and actually the scientists called for a huge investigation to understand climate modeling better. And what they discovered was that we're pumping a lot of particles into the air, particularly sulfates from burning coal.
Yes.
And these reflect light and interact with the clouds in a different way. And they reflect light. And so actually the light falling on the surface of the amount of light that reaches the Earth now has been reduced by about 5% over the last 50, 60 years.
Okay, well then, in my average mind, that says that things should be cooler. If you have 5% less light hitting Earth, then you have a cooler.
That's what was going on in the 70s. But you've got two effects. You've got solar dimming making it cooler, and then you've got global warming because of CO2 greenhouse gases making it warmer. And what happened was in the 70s, with the Clean Air Act, immediately, the United States, or very close to immediately, stopped producing particulates, greatly reduced the sulfate production, and now the solar dimming over the United States diminished, the CO2 production went up. And so all of a sudden, you've got the CO2 production, the global warming, outrunning the solar dimming. Now, what's scary about this is that the Chinese, who are burning coal like crazy, have got this huge problem with particulates. I've never been to China, but I've seen pictures, and it looks horrible. It looks like the worst days in L.A.
Well, it is. I was recently there. I've been to Bangkok. Bangkok is so bad, Professor, that about 40% of the street police have lung problems, lung disease. It actually hurts to breathe most days in Bangkok. And if you go on up into the industrial areas of mainland China, same deal. It's beyond anything you can imagine.
Yeah, it's, and the Chinese are aware of this, and they have begun to enact laws to do exactly the same thing, to reduce the amount of sulfates in the air, because it is an incredible health hazard. It causes acid rain, and it's a health hazard.
Yes, but if they do what we did, and they continue to use the kind of energy you're talking about, and they stop the global dimming or the dimming over their part of the globe, then it's going to warm there as well. And so we're going to double the amount of global warming.
Yeah.
If I heard you correctly, did I?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. Hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. We'll be right back.